entries day and night. It was near his palace on the edge of the city, where all his followers lived. So when El Herrera talked of stealing King Darzan's lettuces, Prince Rainbow laughed and said, "You can try, El Herrera, and if you succeed, I will multiply your people everywhere, and no one will be able to keep them out of a vegetable garden from now till the end of the world. But what will really happen is that you will be killed by the soldiers, and the world will be rid of a smooth, plausible rascal." "Very well," said El Herrera. "We shall see." Now, Yona, the hedgehog, was nearby, looking for slugs and snails in the marshes, and he heard what passed between Prince Rainbow and El Herrera. He slipped away to the great palace of King Darzan and begged to be rewarded for warning him against his enemies.
"King Darzan," he sniffled, "that wicked thief, El Herrera, has said he will steal your lettuces, and he is coming to trick you and get into the garden."
King Darzan hurried down to the lettuce garden and sent for the captain of the guard. "You see these lettuces?" he said. "Not one of them has been stolen since the seed was sown. Very soon now they will be ready, and then I mean to hold a great feast for all my people. But I have heard that that scoundrel, El Herrera, means to come and steal them if he can. You are to double the guards, and all the gardeners and weeders are to be examined every day. Not one leaf is to go out of the garden until either I or my chief taster gives the order." The captain of the guard did as he was told. That night, El Herrera came out of the marshes of Kelfazin and went secretly up to the great ditch. With him was his trusty captain of Ausla, Rab Scuttle. They squatted in the bushes and watched the doubled guards patrolling up and down. When the morning came, they saw all the gardeners and weeders coming up to the wall, and everyone was looked at by three guards. One was new and had come instead of his uncle who was ill, but the guards would not let him in because they did not know him by sight, and they nearly threw him into the ditch before they would even let him go home. El Herrera and Rab Scuttle came away in perplexity. And that day, when Prince Rainbow came walking through the fields, he said, "Well, well, Prince with a thousand enemies, where are the lettuces?" "I'm having them delivered," answered El Herrera. "There will be rather too many to carry." Then he and Rab Scuttle went secretly down one of their few holes where there was no water, put a sentry outside, and thought and talked for a day and a night. On the top of the hill near King Darzan's palace, there was a garden, and here his many children and his chief followers' children used to be taken to play by their mothers and nursemaids. There was no wall round the garden. It was guarded only when the children were there. At night, it was empty, because there was nothing to steal and no one to be hunted. The next night, Rab Scuttle, who had been told by El Herrera what he had to do, went to the garden and dug a scrape. He hid in the scrape all night, and the next morning, when the children were brought to play, he slipped out and joined them. There were so many children that each one of the mothers and nursemaids thought that he must belong to somebody else. But as he was about the same size as the children, and not much different to look at, he was able to make friends with some of them. Rab Scuttle was full of tricks and games, and quite soon he was running and playing just as if he had been one of the children himself. When the time came for the children to go home, Rab Scuttle went too. They came up to the gate of the city, and the guards saw Rab Scuttle with King Darzan's son. They stopped him and asked which was his mother, but the king's son said, "You let him alone. He's my friend." And Rab Scuttle went in with all the others. Now, as soon as Rab Scuttle got inside the king's palace, he scurried off and went into one of the dark burrows, and here he hid all day. But in the evening, he came out and made his way to the royal storerooms, where the food was being got ready for the king and his chief followers and wives. There were grasses and fruits and roots and even nuts and berries, for King Darzan's people went everywhere in those days, through the woods and fields. There were no soldiers in the storerooms, and Rabscuttle hid there in the dark, and he did all he could to make the food bad, except what he ate himself. That evening King Darzan sent for the chief taster and asked them whether the lettuces were ready. The chief taster said that several of them were excellent and that he had already had some brought into the stores.
Good, said the king. We will have two or three tonight.
But the next morning, the king and several of his people were taken ill with bad stomachs. Whatever they ate, they kept on getting ill, because Rabscuttle was hiding in the storerooms and spoiling the food as fast as it was brought in. The king ate several more lettuces, but he got no better. In fact, he got worse. After 5 days, Rabscuttle slipped out again with the children and came back to Erarera. When he heard that the king was ill and that Rabscuttle had done all he wanted, Erarera set to work to disguise himself. He clipped his white tail and made Rabscuttle nibble his fur short and stain it with mud and blackberries. Then he covered himself all over with trailing strands of goose grass and big burdocks, and even found ways to alter his smell. At last, even his own wives could not recognize him, and Erarera told Rabscuttle to follow some way behind, and off he went to King Darzan's palace. But Rabscuttle waited outside on the top of the hill. When he got to the palace, Erarera demanded to see the captain of the guard.
"You are to take me to the king," he said. "Prince Rainbow has sent me. He has heard that the king is ill, and he has sent for me from the distant land beyond Kelfazin to find the cause of his sickness. Be quick! I'm not accustomed to be kept waiting."
"How do I know this is true?" asked the captain of the guard.
"It's all one to me," replied Erarera. "What is the sickness of a little king to the chief physician of the land beyond the golden river of Frith?
I will return and tell Prince Rainbow that the king's guard were foolish and gave me such treatment as one might expect from a crowd of flea-bitten louts."
He turned and began to go away, but the captain of the guard became frightened, called him back. Erarera allowed himself to be persuaded, and the soldiers took him to the king. After 5 days of bad food and bad stomach, the king was not inclined to be suspicious of someone who said that Prince Rainbow had sent him to make him better. He begged Erarera to examine him and promised to do all he said. Erarera made a great business of examining the king. He looked at his eyes and his ears and his teeth and his droppings and the ends of his claws, and he inquired what he had been eating. Then he demanded to see the royal storerooms and the lettuce garden. When he came back, he looked very grave and said, "Great king, I know well what sorry news it will be to you, but the cause of your sickness is those very lettuces by which you set such store."
"The lettuces!" cried King Darzan. "Impossible! They're all grown from good, healthy seed and guarded day and night."
"Alas," said Erarera, "I know it well, but they have been infected by the dreaded louse-pedoodle that flies in ever-decreasing circles through the gun-part of the clodgy. A deadly virus, dear me, yes, isolated by the purple of Ago and maturing in the grey-green forests of Eokipoki. This, you understand, is to put the matter for you in simple terms, insofar as I can. Medically speaking, there are certain complexities with which I will not weary you."
"I cannot believe it," said the king.
"The simplest course,"
said Elerina, will be to prove it to you. But we need not make one of your subjects ill. Tell the soldiers to go out and take a prisoner. The soldiers went out, and the first creature they found was Rabscuttle, grazing on the hilltop. They dragged him through the gates and into the king's presence. Ah, a rabbit, said Elerina. Nasty creature. So much the better. Disgusting rabbit. Eat that lettuce. Rabscuttle did so, and soon afterward he began to moan and thrash about. He kicked in convulsions and rolled his eyes. He gnawed at the floor and frothed at the mouth. He is very ill, said Elerina. He must have got an exceptionally bad one. Or else, which is more probable, the infection is particularly deadly to rabbits. But in any event, let us be thankful it was not your majesty. Throw him out! I would strongly advise your majesty, went on Elerina, not to leave the lettuces where they are, for they will shoot and flower and seed. The infection will spread. I know it is disappointing, but you must get rid of them. At that moment, as luck would have it, in came the captain of the guard with Yona the hedgehog. Your majesty, he cried, this creature returns from the marches of Kelfazin. The people of Elerera are mustering for war. They say they are coming to attack your majesty's garden and steal the royal lettuces. May I have your majesty's order to take out the soldiers and destroy them? Aha, said the king. I have thought of a trick worth two of that. Particularly deadly to rabbits. Well, well, let them have all the lettuces they want. In fact, you are to take 1,000 down to the marshes of Kelfazin and leave them there. Ho, ho, what a joke! I feel all the better for it. Ah, what deadly cunning, said Elerina. No wonder your majesty is ruler of a great people. I believe you are already recovering. As with many illnesses, the cure is simple once perceived. No, no, I will accept no reward. In any case, there is nothing here that would be thought of value in the shining land beyond the golden river of Frith. I have done as Prince Rainbow required. It is sufficient. Perhaps you will be so good as to tell your guards to accompany me to the foot of the hill. He bowed and left the palace. Later that evening, as Elerina was urging his rabbits to growl more fiercely and run up and down in the marshes of Kelfazin, Prince Rainbow came over the river. Elerina, he called, am I bewitched? It is quite possible, said Elerina. The dreaded Louspadoodle. There are 1,000 lettuces in a pile at the top of the marsh. Who put them there? I told you they were being delivered, said Elerina. You could hardly expect my people, weak and hungry as they are, to carry them all the way from King Darzin's garden. However, they will soon recover now, under the treatment that I shall prescribe. I'm a physician, I may say, and if you have not heard as much, Prince Rainbow, you may take it that you soon will, from another quarter. Rabscuttle, go out and collect the lettuces. Then Prince Rainbow saw that Elerina had been as good as his word, and that he himself must keep his promise too. He let the rabbits out of the marshes of Kelfazin, and they multiplied everywhere. And from that day to this, no power on earth can keep a rabbit out of a vegetable garden, for Elerina prompts them with 1,000 tricks, the best in the world.
Chapter 16. Silverweed. He said, dance for me. And he said, you are too beautiful for the wind to pick at or the sun to burn. He said, I'm a poor tattered thing, but not unkind to the sad dancer
and the dancing dead. Sydney Keys, Four Postures of Death.
Well done, said Hazel, as Dandelion ended.
He's very good, isn't he? Said Silver. We're lucky to have him with us. It raises your spirits just to hear him.
Let's put their ears flat for them, whispered Bigwig. Let's just see them find a storyteller to beat him.
They were all in no doubt that Dandelion had done them credit. Ever since their arrival, most of them had felt out of their depth among these magnificent, well-fed strangers, with their detached manners, their shapes on the wall, their elegance, their adroit evasion of almost all questions, above all, their fits of unrabbit-like melancholy. Now, their own storyteller had shown that they were no mere bunch of tramps. Certainly no reasonable rabbit could withhold admiration. They waited to be told as much, but after a few moments realized with surprise that their hosts were evidently less enthusiastic.
Very nice, said Cowslip.
He seemed to be searching for something more to say, but then repeated,
Yes, very nice. An unusual tale.
But he must know it, surely,
muttered Blackberry to Hazel.
I always think these traditional stories retain a lot of charm, said another of the rabbits, especially when they're told in the real old-fashioned spirit.
Yes, said Strawberry. Conviction. That's what it needs. You really have to believe in El Herrera and Prince Rainbow, don't you? Then all the rest follows.
Don't say anything, Bigwig, whispered Hazel, for Bigwig was scuffing his paws indignantly.
You can't force them to like it if they don't. Let's wait and see what they can do themselves.
Aloud, he said,
Our stories haven't changed in generations, you know. After all, we haven't changed ourselves. Our lives have been the same as our fathers, and their fathers before them. Things are different here. We realize that, and we think your new ideas and ways are very exciting. We're all wondering what kind of things you tell stories about.
Well, we don't tell the old stories very much, said Cowslip. Our stories and poems are mostly about our own lives here. Of course, that shape of Laburnum that you saw, that's old-fashioned now. El Herrera doesn't really mean much to us. Not that your friend's story wasn't very charming, he added hastily.
El Herrera is a trickster, said Buckthorn, and rabbits will always need tricks.
No,
said a new voice from the further end of the hall, beyond Cowslip.
Rabbits need dignity, and above all, the will to accept their fate.
We think Silverweed is one of the best poets we have had for many months, said Cowslip. His ideas have a great following. Would you like to hear him now?
Yes, yes, said voices from all sides. Silverweed!
Hazel, said Fiver suddenly.
I want to get a clear idea of the Silverweed, but I daren't go closer by myself. Will you come with me?
Why, Fiver, whatever do you mean? What is there to be afraid of?
Frith, help me,
said Fiver, trembling.
I can smell him from here. He terrifies me.
Oh, Fiver, don't be absurd. He just smells the same as the rest of them.
He smells like barley rained down and left to rot in the fields. He smells like a wounded mole that can't get underground.
He smells like a big fat rabbit to me, with a lot of carrots inside. But I'll come with you. When they had edged their way through the crowd to the far end of the burrow, Hazel was surprised to realize that Silverweed was a mere youngster. In the Sandalford Warren, no rabbit of his age would have been asked to tell a story, except perhaps to a few friends alone. He had a wild, desperate air, and his ears twitched continually. As he began to speak, he seemed to grow less and less aware of his audience, and continually turned his head, as though listening to some sound, audible only to himself, from the entrance tunnel behind him. But there was an arresting fascination in his voice, like the movement of wind and light on a meadow. And as its rhythm entered into his hearers, the whole burrow became silent.
"The wind is blowing over the grass. It shakes the willow catkins. The leaves shine silver."
"Where are you going, wind?"
"Far, far away. Over the hills, over the edge of the world.
Take me with you, wind, high over the sky. I will go with you. I will be rabbit of the wind into the sky, the feathery sky and the rabbit."
"The stream is running over the gravel, through the brooklime, the kingcups, the blue and gold of spring."
"Where are you going, stream?"
"Far, far away, beyond the heather, sliding away all night. Take me with you, stream, away in the starlight.
I will go with you. I will be rabbit of the stream. Down through the water, the green water and the rabbit.
In autumn the leaves come blowing yellow and brown. They rustle in the ditches, they tug and hang on the hedge.
Where are you going, leaves?
Far, far away. Into the earth we go, with the rain and the berries.
Take me, leaves. Oh, take me on your dark journey. I will go with you. I will be rabbit of the leaves. In the deep places of the earth and the rabbit.
Frith lies in the evening sky.
The clouds are red about him.
I am here, Lord Frith. I am running through the long grass.
Oh, take me with you, dropping behind the woods, far away to the heart of light, the silence, for I am ready to give you my breath, my life,
the shining circle of the sun, and the rabbit.
Fiver, as he listened, had shown a mixture of intense absorption and incredulous horror. At one and the same time, he seemed to accept every word and yet to be stricken with fear. Once he drew in his breath, as though startled to recognize his own half-known thoughts, and when the poem was ended, he seemed to be struggling to come to himself. He bared his teeth and licked his lips as Blackberry had done before the dead hedgehog on the road.
A rabbit in fear of an enemy will sometimes crouch stock still, either fascinated or else trusting to its natural inconspicuousness to remain unnoticed. But then, unless the fascination is too powerful, there comes the point when keeping still is discarded, and the rabbit, as though breaking a spell, turns in an instant to its other resource, flight. So it seemed to be with Fiver now. Suddenly, he leaped up and began to push his way violently across the great burrow. Several rabbits were jostled and turned angrily on him, but he took no notice. Then he came to a place where he could not push between two heavy warren bucks. He became hysterical, kicking and scuffling, and Hazel, who was behind him, had difficulty in preventing a fight.
"My brother's a sort of poet too, you know," he said to the bristling strangers. "Things affect him very strongly sometimes, and he doesn't always know why."
One of the rabbits seemed to accept what Hazel had said, but the other replied,
"Oh, another poet? Let's hear him then. That'll be some return for my shoulder anyway. He scratched a great tuft of fur out."
Fiver was already beyond them, and thrusting toward the further entrance tunnel. Hazel felt that he must follow him, but after all the trouble that he himself had taken to be friendly, he felt so cross at the way in which Fiver had antagonized their new friends that as he passed Bigwig, he said, "Come and help me to get some sense into him. The last thing we want is a fight now." He felt that Fiver really deserved a short touch of Bigwig. They followed Fiver up the run
and overtook him at the entrance. Before either of them could say a word, he turned and began to speak as though they had asked him a question.
"You felt it, then? And you want to know whether I did? Of course I did. That's the worst part of it. There isn't any trick. He speaks the truth. So as long as he speaks the truth, it can't be folly. That's what you're going to say, isn't it? I'm not blaming you, Hazel. I felt myself moving toward him like one cloud drifting into another. But then, at the last moment, I drifted wide. Who knows why? It wasn't my own will. It was an accident. There was just some little part of me that carried me wide of him. Did I say the roof of that hall was made of bones?
No.
It's like a great mist of folly that covers the whole sky. And we shall never see to go by Frith's light any more. Oh, what will become of us? A thing can be true and still be desperate folly, Hazel.
What on earth's all this?
Said Hazel to Bigwig in perplexity.
He's talking about that lop-eared nitwit of a poet down there, answered Bigwig. I know that much. But why he seems to think we should want to have anything to do with him and his fancy talk, that's more than I can imagine. You can save your breath, Fiver. The only thing that's bothering us is the row you started. As for Silverweed, all I can say is, I'll keep Silver, and he can be just plain weed.
Fiver gazed back at him, with eyes that, like a fly's, seemed larger than his head.
You think that?
He said.
You believe that? But each of you, in his own way, is thick in that mist.
Where is the... Hazel interrupted him, and as he did so, Fiver started. Fiver, I won't pretend that I didn't follow you up here to speak angrily. You've endangered our good start in this warren.
Endangered? Cried Fiver. Endangered? Why, the whole place...
Be quiet. I was going to be angry, but you're obviously so much upset that it would be pointless. But what you are going to do now is to come underground with the two of us and sleep. Come on! And don't say any more for the moment.
One respect in which rabbits' lives are less complicated than those of humans is that they are not ashamed to use force. Having no alternative, Fiver accompanied Hazel and Bigwig to the burrow where Hazel had spent the previous night. There was no one there, and they lay down and slept.
Chapter 17. The Shining Wire. When the green field comes off like a lid, revealing what was much better hid, unpleasant, and look, behind, without a sound, the woods have come up and are standing round in deadly crescent, and the bolt is sliding in its groove, outside the window is the black remover's van, and now with sudden, swift emergence, come the women in dark glasses, the hump-backed surgeons, and the scissor man. W.H. Auden, The Witnesses. It was cold and the roof was made of bones. The roof was made of the interlaced sprays of the yew tree. Stiff twigs twisted in and out, over and under, hard as ice and set with dull red berries.
Come on, Hazel, said Cowslip. We're going to carry the yew berries home in our mouths and eat them in the great burrow. Your friends must learn to do that if they want to go our way.
No, no, cried Fiver. Hazel, no.
But then came Bigwig, twisting in and out of the branches, his mouth full of berries.
Look, said Bigwig, I can do it. I'm running another way. Ask me where, Hazel. Ask me where. Ask me where.
Then they were running another way, running, not to the warren, but over the fields and the cold. And Bigwig dropped the berries, blood, red drops, red droppings, hard as wire.
It's no good, he said. No good biting them. They're cold.
Hazel woke. He was in the burrow. He shivered. Why was there no warmth of rabbit bodies lying close together?
Where was Fiver? He sat up. Nearby, Bigwig was stirring and twitching in his sleep, searching for warmth, trying to press against another rabbit's body no longer there. The shallow hollow in the sandy floor where Fiver had lain was not quite cold, but Fiver was gone.
Fiver!
Said Hazel in the dark.
As soon as he had spoken, he knew there would be no reply. He pushed Bigwig with his nose, butting urgently.
Bigwig! Five has gone! Bigwig!
Bigwig was wide awake on the instant, and Hazel had never felt so glad of his sturdy readiness.
What did you say? What's wrong?
Five has gone.
Where's he gone?
Sylph, outside. It can only be Sylph. You know he wouldn't go wandering about in the warren. He hates it.
He's a nuisance, isn't he? He's left this burrow cold, too. You think he's in danger, don't you? You want to go and look for him?
Yes, I must. He's upset and overwrought, and it's not light yet. There may be Elil, whatever Strawberry says.
Bigwig listened and sniffed for a few moments.
It's very nearly light, he said.
There'll be light enough to find him by.
Well, I'd better come with you, I suppose.
Don't worry, he can't have gone far. But by the king's lettuce, I won't half give him a piece of my mind when we catch him.
I'll hold him down while you kick him, if only we can find him. Come on.
They went up the run to the mouth of the hole and paused together. Since our friends aren't here to push us, said Bigwig, we may as well make sure the place isn't crawling with stoats and owls before we go out. At that moment, a brown owl's call sounded from the opposite wood. It was the first call, and by instinct they both crouched, motionless, counting four heartbeats until the second followed.
It's moving away, said Hazel.
How many field mice say that every night, I wonder? You know the call's deceptive. It's meant to be.
Well, I can't help it, said Hazel. Five are somewhere out there, and I'm going after him. You were right anyway. It is light, just.
Shall we look under the yew tree first?
But Fiver was not under the yew tree.
The light, as it grew, began to show the upper field, while the distant hedge and brook remained dark, linear shapes below. Bigwig jumped down from the bank into the field and ran in a long curve across the wet grass. He stopped almost opposite the hole by which they had come up, and Hazel joined him.
Here's his line, all right, said Bigwig. Fresh, too. From the hole straight down toward the brook. He won't be far away.
When raindrops are lying, it is easy to see where the grass has recently been crossed. They followed the line down the field and reached the hedge beside the carrot ground and the source of the brook. Bigwig had been right when he said the line was fresh. As soon as they had come through the hedge, they saw Fiver. He was feeding alone. A few fragments of carrot were still lying about near the spring, but he had left these untouched and was eating the grass not far from the gnarled crab apple tree. They approached, and he looked up.
Hazel said nothing and began to feed beside him. He was now regretting that he had brought Bigwig. In the darkness before morning and the first shock of discovering that Fiver was gone, Bigwig had been a comfort and a standby. But now, as he saw Fiver small and familiar, incapable of hurting anyone or of concealing what he felt, trembling in the wet grass, either from fear or from cold, his anger melted away. He felt only sorry for him, and sure that, if they could stay alone together for a while, Fiver would come round to an easier state of mind. But it was probably too late to persuade Bigwig to be gentle. He could only hope for the best. Contrary to his fears, however, Bigwig remained as silent as himself. Evidently, he had been expecting Hazel to speak first, and was somewhat at a loss. For some time, all three moved on quietly over the grass, while the shadows grew stronger and the wood pigeons clattered among the distant trees. Hazel was beginning to feel that all would be well, and that Bigwig had more sense than he had given him credit for, when Fiver sat up on his hind legs, cleaned his face with his paws, and then, for the first time, looked directly at him.
"I'm going now," he said. "I feel very sad. I'd like to wish you well, Hazel, but there's no good to wish you in this place. So just goodbye."
"But where are you going, Fiver?"
"Away, to the hills, if I can get there."
"By yourself? Alone? You can't. You'd die."
"You would never hope, old chap," said Bigwig. "Something would get you before Nefrith."
"No," said Fiver, very quietly. "You are closer to death."
than I.
"Are you trying to frighten me, you miserable little lump of chattering chickweed?" cried Bigwig. "I've a good mind to—"
"Wait, Bigwig," said Hazel. "Don't speak roughly to him."
"Why, you said yourself—" began Bigwig.
"I know, but I feel differently now. I'm sorry, Bigwig. I was going to ask you to help me to make him come back to the Warren, but now, well, I've always found that there was something in what Fiver had to say. For the last 2 days I've refused to listen to him, and I still think he's out of his senses. But I haven't the heart to drive him back to the Warren. I really believe that for some reason or other, the place is frightening him out of his wits. I'll go with him a little way and perhaps we can talk. I can't ask you to risk it too. Anyway, the others ought to know what we're doing, and they won't unless you go and tell them. I'll be back before Neafrith. I hope we both shall."
Bigwig stared. Then he turned furiously on Fiver. "You wretched little black beetle," he said. "You've never learned to obey orders, have you? It's me all the time. Oh, I've got a funny feeling in my toe, so we must all go and stand on our heads. And now we've found a fine warren and got into it without even having to fight. You've got to do your best to upset everyone. And then you risk the life of one of the best rabbits we've got, just to play nursey, while you go wandering about like a moonstruck field mouse. Well, I'm finished with you, I'll tell you plain. And now I'm going back to the warren, to make sure everyone else is finished with you as well. And they will be, don't make any mistake about that."
He turned and dashed back through the nearest gap in the hedge. On the instant, a fearful commotion began on the farther side. There were sounds of kicking and plunging. A stick flew into the air. Then a flat, wet clod of dead leaves shot clean through the gap and landed clear of the hedge, close to Hazel. The brambles thrashed up and down. Hazel and Fiver stared at each other, both fighting against the impulse to run. What enemy was at work on the other side of the hedge? There were no cries, no spitting of a cat, no squealing of a rabbit, only the crackling of twigs and the tearing of the grass in violence. By an effort of courage against all instinct, Hazel forced himself forward into the gap, with Fiver following. A terrible sight lay before them. The rotten leaves had been thrown up in showers. The earth had been laid bare and was scored with long scratches and furrows. Bigwig was lying on his side, his back legs kicking and struggling. A length of twisted copper wire, gleaming dully in the first sunlight, was looped round his neck and ran taut across one forepaw to the head of a stout peg driven into the ground. The running knot had pulled tight and was buried in the fur behind his ear. The projecting point of one strand had lacerated his neck, and drops of blood, dark and red as yew berries, welled one by one down his shoulder. For a few moments he lay panting, his side heaving in exhaustion. Then again began the struggling and fighting, backward and forward, jerking and falling, until he choked and lay quiet. Frenzied with distress, Hazel leaped out of the gap and squatted beside him. Bigwig's eyes were closed, and his lips pulled back from the long front teeth in a fixed snarl. He had bitten his lower lip, and from this, too, the blood was running. Froth covered his jaws and chest.
"Thlaeli," said Hazel, stamping. "Thlaeli, listen! You're in a snare! A snare! What did they say in the Ousla? Come on, think! How can we help you?"
There was a pause. Then Bigwig's back legs began to kick once more, but feebly. His ears drooped. His eyes opened, unseeing, and the whites showed bloodshot as the brown irises rolled one way and the other. After a moment, his voice came, thick and low, bubbling out of the bloody spume in his mouth.
"Ousla, no good. Biting wire. Beg. Good. Dig out."
A convulsion shook him and he scrabbled to the ground, covering himself in a mask of wet earth and blood. Then he was still again.
"Run, Fiver, run to the warren," cried Hazel. "Get the others, Blackberry, Silver, be quick, he'll die."
Fiver was off up the field like a hare. Hazel, left alone, tried to understand what was needed. What was the peg? How was he to dig it out? He looked down at the foul mess before him. Bigwig was lying across the wire, which came out under his belly and seemed to disappear into the ground. Hazel struggled with his own incomprehension. Bigwig had said, "Dig,"
That at least he understood. He began to scratch into the soft earth beside the body, until after a time his claws scraped against something smooth and firm. As he paused, perplexed, he found Blackberry at his shoulder.
Bigwig just spoke, he said to him. But I don't think he can now. He said, dig out the peg. What does that mean? What have we got to do?
Wait a moment, said Blackberry. Let me think and try not to be impatient.
Hazel turned his head and looked down the course of the brook. Far away, between the two copses, he could see the cherry tree where 2 days before he had sat with Blackberry and Fiver in the sunrise. He remembered how Bigwig had chased Hawkbit through the long grass, forgetting the quarrel of the previous night in the joy of their arrival. He could see Hawkbit running toward him now, and two or three of the others, Silver, Dandelion, and Pipkin. Dandelion, well in front, dashed up to the gap and checked, twitching and staring.
"What is it, Hazel? What's happened?" Fiver said. "Bigwig's in a wire. Let him alone till Blackberry tells us. Stop the others crowding round."
Dandelion turned and raced back as Pipkin came up.
"Is Cowslip coming?" said Hazel. "Perhaps he knows."
"He wouldn't come," replied Pipkin. "He told Fiver to stop talking about it."
"Told him what?" asked Hazel incredulously.
But at that moment, Blackberry spoke, and Hazel was beside him in a flash.
"This is it," said Blackberry. "The wire's on a peg, and the peg's in the ground. There, look. We've got to dig it out. Come on, dig beside it."
Hazel dug once more, his forepaws throwing up the soft, wet soil and slipping against the hard sides of the peg. Dimly, he was aware of the others waiting nearby. After a time, he was forced to stop, panting. Silver took his place and was followed by Buckthorn. The nasty, smooth, clean, man-smelling peg was laid bare to the length of a rabbit's ear, but still it did not come loose. Bigwig had not moved. He lay across the wire, torn and bloody, with closed eyes. Buckthorn drew his head and paws out of the hole and rubbed the mud off his face. "The peg's narrower down there," he said. "It tapers. I think it could be bitten through, but I can't get my teeth into it."
"Send Pipkin in," said Blackberry. "He's smaller."
Pipkin plunged into the hole. They could hear the wood splintering under his teeth, a sound like a mouse in a shed wainscot at midnight. He came out with his nose bleeding.
"The splinters prick you and it's hard to breathe, but the peg's nearly through."
"Fiver, go in,"
said Hazel. Fiver was not long in the hole. He too came out bleeding.
"It's broken in two. It's free."
Blackberry pressed his nose against Bigwig's head. As he nuzzled him gently, the head rolled sideways and back again.
"Bigwig,"
said Blackberry in his ear.
"The peg's out."
There was no response. Bigwig lay still as before. A great fly settled on one of his ears. Blackberry thrust at it angrily, and it flew up, buzzing into the sunshine.
"I think he's gone," said Blackberry. "I can't feel his breathing."
Hazel crouched down by Blackberry and laid his nostrils close to Bigwig's. But a light breeze was blowing, and he could not tell whether there was breath or not. The legs were loose, the belly flaccid and limp. He tried to think of what little he had heard of snares. A strong rabbit could break his neck in a snare, or had the point of the sharp wire pierced the windpipe.
"Pickwick,"
he whispered,
"we've got you out. You're free."
Bigwig did not stir. Suddenly it came to Hazel that if Bigwig was dead, and what else could hold him silent in the mud, then he himself must get the others away before the dreadful loss could drain their courage and break their spirit, as it would if they stayed by the body. Besides, the man would come soon. Perhaps he was already coming, with his gun, to take poor Bigwig away. They must go, and he must do his best to see that all of them, even he himself, put what had happened out of mind forever.
"My heart has joined a thousand, for my friend stopped running today," he said to Blackberry, quoting a rabbit proverb.
"If only it were not Bigwig,"
said Blackberry.
"What shall we do without him?"
"The others are waiting," said Hazel. "We have to stay alive. There has to be something for them to think about. Help me, or it will be more than I can do." He turned away from the body and looked for Fiver among the rabbits behind him.
But Fiver was nowhere to be seen, and Hazel was afraid to ask for him, in case to do so should seem like weakness and a need for comfort.
"Pipkin," he snapped, "why don't you clean up your face and stop the bleeding? The smell of blood attracts a lil. You know that, don't you?"
"Yes, Hazel, I'm sorry."
"Will Bigwig—"
"And another thing," said Hazel desperately.
"What was it you were telling me about Cowslip? Did you say he told Fiver to be quiet?"
"Yes, Hazel. Fiver came into the warren and told us about the snare and that poor Bigwig—"
"Yes, all right. And then Cowslip—"
"Cowslip and Strawberry and the others pretended not to hear. It was ridiculous because Fiver was calling out to everybody. And then, as we were running out, Silver said to Cowslip, 'Surely you're coming.' And Cowslip simply turned his back. So then Fiver went up and spoke to him very quietly. But I heard what Cowslip answered. He said, 'Hills or Inlay, it's all one to me where you go. You hold your tongue.' And then he struck at Fiver, scratched his ear."
"Oh, kill him!"
gasped a low, choking voice behind them. They all leapt round. Bigwig had raised his head and was supporting himself on his forepaws alone. His body was twisted, and his hind parts and back legs still lay along the ground. His eyes were open, but his face was such a fearful mask of blood, foam, vomit, and earth that he looked more like some demon creature than a rabbit. The immediate sight of him, which should have filled them with relief and joy, brought only terror. They cringed away, and none said a word.
"Oh, kill him!"
repeated Bigwig, spluttering through his fouled whiskers and clotted fur.
"Help me, rot you! Can't anyone get this stinky wire off me?"
He struggled, dragging his hind legs. Then he fell again, and crawled forward, trailing the wire through the grass with the broken peg snickering behind it.
"Let him alone," cried Hazel, for now they were all pressing forward to help him. "Do you want to kill him? Let him rest. Let him breathe."
"No, not rest," panted Bigwig. "I'm all right."
As he spoke, he fell again, and immediately struggled up on his forepaws as before.
"It's my back legs. Won't move. That cowslip. I'll kill him."
"Why do we let them stay in that warren?" cried Silver. "What sort of rabbits are they? They left Bigwig to die. You all heard Cowslip in the burrow. They're cowards. Let's drive them out, kill them, take the warren and live there ourselves."
"Yes, yes," they all answered. "Come on, back to the warren. Down with Cowslip. Down with Silverweed. Kill them."
"O Embly of Frith!"
cried a squealing voice in the long grass. At this shocking impiety, the tumult died away. They looked about them, wondering who could have spoken. There was silence. Then, from between two great tussocks of hair grass came Fiver, his eyes blazing with a frantic urgency. He growled and gibbered at them like a witch hare, and those nearest to him fell back in fear. Even Hazel could not have said a word for his life. They realized that he was speaking.
"The warren! You're going to the warren! You fools! That warren's nothing but a death hole! The whole place is one foul and ill's larder. It's snared everywhere, every day. That explains everything. Everything that's happened since we came here."
He sat still, and his words seemed to come crawling up the sunlight over the grass.
"Listen, Dandelion, you're fond of stories, aren't you? I'll tell you one. Yes, one for Elerera to cry at. Once, there was a fine warren on the edge of a wood, overlooking the meadows of a farm. It was big, full of rabbits. Then one day, the white blindness came, and the rabbits fell sick and died. But a few survived, as they always do. The warren became almost empty. One day, the farmer thought, 'I could increase those rabbits, make them part of my farm, their meat, their skins. Why should I bother to keep rabbits in hutches? They'll do very well where they are.'
he began to shoot all Elil, Lendry, Homba, Stoat, Owl. He put out food for the rabbits, but not too near the warren. For his purpose, they had to become accustomed to going about in the fields and the wood. And then he snared them. Not too many. As many as he wanted, and not as many as would frighten them all away or destroy the warren. They grew big and strong and healthy, for he saw to it that they had all of the best, particularly in winter, and nothing to fear, except the running knot in the hedge gap and the woodpath. So they lived as he wanted them to live, and all the time there were a few who disappeared. The rabbits became strange in many ways, different from other rabbits. They knew well enough what was happening, but even to themselves they pretended that all was well. For the food was good, they were protected, they had nothing to fear but the one fear. And that struck here and there, never enough at a time to drive them away. They forgot the ways of wild rabbits. They forgot Elerera, for what use had they for tricks and cunning, living in the enemy's warren and paying his price? They found out other marvellous arts to take the place of tricks and old stories. They danced in ceremonious greeting. They sang songs like the birds and made shapes on the walls. And though these could help them not at all, yet they passed the time and enabled them to tell themselves that they were splendid fellows, the very flower of rabbitry, cleverer than magpies. They had no chief rabbit. No, how could they? For a chief rabbit must be Elerera to his warren and keep them from death. And here there was no death but one. And what chief rabbit could have an answer to that? Instead, Frith sent them strange singers, beautiful and sick like oak apples, like robin's pincushions on the wild rose. And since they could not bear the truth, these singers, who might in some other place have been wise, were squeezed under the terrible weight of the warren's secret until they gulped out fine folly about dignity and acquiescence and anything else that could make believe that the rabbit loved the shining wire. But one strict rule they had. Oh yes, the strictest. No one must ever ask where another rabbit was, and anyone who asked where, except in a song or a poem, must be silenced. To say where was bad enough, but to speak openly of the wires, that was intolerable. For that, they would scratch and kill.
He stopped. No one moved. Then, in the silence, Bigwig lurched to his feet, swayed a moment, tottered a few steps toward Fiver and fell again. Fiver paid him no heed, but looked from one to another among the rabbits. Then he began speaking again.
And then we came, over the heather in the night. Wild rabbits, making scrapes across the valley. The warren rabbits didn't show themselves at once. They needed to think what was best to be done. But they hit on it quite soon. To bring us into the warren and tell us nothing. Don't you see? The farmer only sets so many snares at a time, and if one rabbit dies, the others will live that much longer. You suggested that Hazel should tell them our adventures, Blackberry, but it didn't go down well, did it? Who wants to hear about brave deeds when he's ashamed of his own? And who likes an open, honest tale from someone he's deceiving? Do you want me to go on? I tell you, every single thing that's happened fits like a bee in a foxglove. And kill them, you say, and help ourselves to the great burrow. We shall help ourselves to a roof of bones, hung with shining wires.
help ourselves to misery and death.
Fiver sank down into the grass. Bigwig, still trailing his horrible, smooth peg, staggered up to him and touched his nose with his own.
I'm still alive, Fiver, he said. So are all of us. You've bitten through a bigger peg than this one I'm dragging. Tell us what to do.
Do,
replied Fiver.
Why? Go. Now. I told Cowslip we were going before I left the burrow.
Where?
Said Bigwig, but it was Hazel who answered.
To the hills, he said.
South of them, the ground rose gently away from the brook. Along the crest was the line of a cart track, and beyond, a copse. Hazel turned toward it, and the rest began to follow him up the slope in ones and twos. What about the wire, Bigwig? Said Silver. The peg will catch and tighten it again.
No, it's loose now, said Bigwig. I could shake it off if I hadn't hurt my neck.
Try, said Silver. You won't get far otherwise.
Hazel, said Speedwell suddenly. There's a rabbit coming down from the warren. Look.
Only one, said Bigwig. What a pity. You take him, Silver. I won't deprive you. Make a good job of it while you're at it.
They stopped and waited, dotted here and there about the slope. The rabbit who was coming was running in a curious headlong manner. Once he ran straight into a thick-stemmed thistle, knocking himself sideways and rolling over and over. But he got up and came blundering on toward them.
Is it the white blindness? Said Buckthorn. He's not looking where he's going.
Fifth forbid,
said Blackberry.
Shall we run away?
No, he couldn't run like that with the white blindness, said Hazel. Whatever ails him, it isn't that.
It's Strawberry,
cried Dandelion.
Strawberry came through the hedge by the crab-apple tree, looked about him, and made his way to Hazel. All his urbane self-possession had vanished. He was staring and trembling, and his great size seemed only to add to his air of stricken misery. He cringed before them in the grass as Hazel waited, stern and motionless, with Sliver at his side.
Hazel,
said Strawberry,
are you going away?
Hazel made no answer, but Silver said sharply, what's that to you?
Take me with you.
There was no reply, and he repeated,
take me with you.
We don't care for creatures who deceive us, said Silver. Better go back to Nildrohane. No doubt she's less particular.
Strawberry gave a kind of choking squeal, as though he had been wounded. He looked from Silver to Hazel and then to Fiver. At last, in a pitiful whisper, he said,
the wires.
Silver was about to answer, but Hazel spoke first.
You can come with us, he said. Don't say any more. Poor fellow.
A few minutes later, the rabbits had crossed the cart track and vanished into the copse beyond.
A magpie, seeing some light-coloured object conspicuous on the empty slope, flew closer to look. But all that lay there was a splintered peg and a twisted length of wire.
Part 2. On Watership Down. Chapter 18. Watership Down. What is now proved was once only imagined. William Blake, The Marriage of Heaven and Hell. It was evening of the following day. The north-facing escarpment of Watership Down, in shadow since early morning, now caught the western sun for an hour before twilight. 300 feet the down rose, vertically in a stretch of no more than 600. A precipitous wall, from the thin belt of trees at the foot to the ridge where the steep flattened out. The light, full and smooth, lay like a gold rind over the turf, the firs and yew bushes, the few wind-stunted thorn trees. From the ridge, the light seemed to cover all the slope below, drowsy and still. But down in the grass itself, between the bushes, in that thick forest trodden by the beetle,
the spider, and the hunting shrew. The moving light was like a wind that danced among them to set them scurrying and weaving. The red rays flickered in and out of the grass stems, flashing minutely on membranous wings, casting long shadows behind the thinnest of filamentary legs, breaking each patch of bare soil into a myriad individual grains. The insects buzzed, whined, hummed, stridulated and droned as the air grew warmer in the sunset. Louder, yet calmer than they, among the trees, sounded the yellowhammer, the linnet and the greenfinch. The larks went up, twittering in the scented air above the down. From the summit, the apparent immobility of the vast blue distance was broken here and there by wisps of smoke and tiny, momentary flashes of glass. Far below lay the fields, green with wheat, the flat pastures grazed by horses, the darker greens of the woods. They, too, like the hillside jungle, were tumultuous with evening. But from the remote height turned to stillness, their fierceness tempered by the air that lay between. At the foot of the turf cliff, Hazel and his companions were crouching under the low branches of two or three spindle trees. Since the previous morning, they had journeyed nearly 3 miles. Their luck had been good, for everyone who had left the warren was still alive. They had splashed through two brooks and wandered fearfully in the deep woodlands west of Eckenswell. They had rested in the straw of a starvel or lonely barn, and woken to find themselves attacked by rats. Silver and Buckthorn, with Bigwig helping them, had covered the retreat until, once all were together outside, they had taken to flight. Buckthorn had been bitten in the foreleg, and the wound, in the manner of a rat bite, was irritant and painful. Skirting a small lake, they had stared to see a great grey fisher bird that stabbed and paddled in the sedge until a flight of wild duck had frightened them away with their clamour. They had crossed more than half a mile of open pasture without a trace of cover, expecting every moment some attack that did not come. They had heard the unnatural humming of a pylon in the summer air and had actually gone beneath it on Fiverr's assurance that it could do them no harm. Now they lay under the spindle trees and sniffed in weariness and doubt at the strange, bare country round them. Since leaving the warren of the snares, they had become warier, shrewder, a tenacious band who understood each other and worked together. There was no more quarrelling. The truth about the warren had been a grim shock. They had come closer together, relying on and valuing each other's capacities. They knew now that it was on these and on nothing else that their lives depended, and they were not going to waste anything they possessed between them. In spite of Hazel's efforts beside the snare, there was not one of them who had not turned sick at heart to think that Bigwig was dead and wondered, like Blackberry, what would become of them now. Without Hazel, without Blackberry, Buckthorn and Pipkin, Bigwig would have died. Without himself, he would have died, for which else of them all would not have stopped running after such punishment? There was no more questioning of Bigwig's strength, Fiverr's insight, Blackberry's wits, or Hazel's authority. When the rats came, Buckthorn and Silver had obeyed Bigwig and stood their ground. The rest had followed Hazel when he roused them, and without explanation told them to go quickly outside the barn. Later, Hazel had said that there was nothing for it but to cross the open pasture, and under Silver's direction they had crossed it, with Dandelion running ahead to reconnoitre. When Fiverr said the iron tree was harmless, they believed him. Strawberry had had a bad time. His misery made him slow-witted and careless, and he was ashamed of the part he had played at the warren. He was soft and more used than he dared admit to indolence and good food. But he made no complaint, and it was plain that he was determined to show what he could do and not be left behind. He had proved useful in the woodland, being better accustomed to thick woods than any of the others,
He'll be all right, you know, if we give him a chance, said Hazel to Bigwig by the lake.
So he darned well ought to be, replied Bigwig. The great dandy.
For by their standards, Strawberry was scrupulously clean and fastidious. Well, I won't have him browbeaten, Bigwig, mind.
That won't help him. This Bigwig had accepted, though rather sulkily.
Yet he himself had become less overbearing. The snare had left him weak and overwrought. It was he who had given the alarm in the barn, for he could not sleep, and at the sound of scratching had started up at once. He would not let Silver and Buckthorn fight alone, but he had felt obliged to leave the worst of it to them. For the first time in his life, Bigwig had found himself driven to moderation and prudence. As the sun sank lower and touched the edge of the cloud belt on the horizon, Hazel came out from under the branches and looked carefully round the lower slope. Then he stared upward, over the anthills, to the open down rising above. Fiver and Acorn followed him out and fell to nibbling at a patch of sandfoin. It was new to them, but they did not need to be told that it was good, and it raised their spirits. Hazel turned back and joined them among the big, rosy-veined, magenta flower spikes.
Fiver, he said, let me get this right. You want us to climb up this place, however far it is, and find shelter on the top, is that it?
Yes, Hazel.
But the top must be very high. I can't even see it from here. It'll be open and cold.
Not in the ground. And the soil's so light that we shall be able to scratch some shelter easily when we find the right place.
Hazel considered again.
It's getting started that bothers me. Here we are, all tired out. I'm sure it's dangerous to stay here. We've nowhere to run to. We don't know the country and we can't get underground. But it seems out of the question for everybody to climb up there tonight. We should be even less safe.
We shall be forced to dig, shan't we? Said Acorn. This place is almost as open as that heather we crossed, and the trees won't hide us from anything hunting on 4 feet.
It would have been the same any time we came, said Fiver.
I'm not saying anything against it, Fiver, replied Acorn. But we need holes. It's a bad place not to be able to get underground.
Before everyone goes up to the top, said Hazel, we ought to find out what it's like. I'm going up myself to have a look round. I'll be as quick as I can, and you'll have to hope for the best until I get back. You can rest and feed anyway.
You're not going alone, said Fiver firmly.
Since each one of them was ready to go with him in spite of their fatigue, Hazel gave in and chose Dandelion and Hawkbit, who seemed less weary than the others. They set out up the hillside, going slowly, picking their way from one bush and tussock to another, and pausing continually to sniff and stare along the great expanse of grass, which stretched on either side as far as they could see. A man walks upright. For him, it is strenuous to climb a steep hill, because he has to keep pushing his own vertical mass upward and cannot gain any momentum. The rabbit is better off. His forelegs support his horizontal body, and the great back legs do the work. They are more than equal to thrusting uphill the light mass in front of them. Rabbits can go fast uphill. In fact, they have so much power behind that they find going downhill awkward, and sometimes, in flight down a steep place, they may actually go head over heels. On the other hand, the man is 5 or 6 feet above the hillside and can see all around. To him the ground may be steep and rough, but on the whole it is even, and he can pick his direction easily from the top of his moving 6-foot tower. The rabbit's anxieties and strain in climbing the down were different, therefore, from those which you, reader, will experience if you go there. Their main trouble was not bodily fatigue. When Hazel had said that they were all tired out, he had meant that they were feeling the strain of prolonged insecurity and fear. Rabbits above ground, unless they are improved, familiar surroundings close to their holes, live in continual fear. If it grows intense enough, they can become glazed and paralyzed by it. Tharn, to use their own word.
Hazel and his companions had been on the jump for nearly 2 days. Indeed, ever since they had left their home warren 5 days before, they had faced one danger after another. They were all on edge, sometimes starting at nothing and again lying down in any patch of long grass that offered.